Okay, well, let's start with a little bit of background information on you. Could you state your full name?
My full name? Oh, boy. Well, William Arthur Stewart is the... I usually use only those full names, though. I was also... They included Edmund in that. William Arthur Edmund Stewart, who was one of my godfathers, but I... It's too cumbersome to use those names. So the... I guess he was William Arthur.
Okay, what's your date and place of birth?
Place of birth is Montreal, August the 21st, 1915.
Mm-hmm. And can you describe your educational background?
Well, I went to Loyola High School in Montreal and college, 8 years there. Then after that, a year later, I worked in business for a year and then went into the Jesuits in 1937, fall of 37, and my education has been largely with the Jesuits ever since. I did most of my studies with the Jesuits in Guelph and in Toronto, and then I was posted down here, and apart from 1 year when I was away on studies in the States, I've been here ever since. They can't get rid of me, it seems. So,
could you describe your research interest?
Well, Lonergan was my area of interest and research. Bernard Lonergan, who was a well-known philosopher and theologian, and whom I had had as a teacher for 5 years, and who's written, all sorts of books and things, but... most of my work and my writing has all been involved with Lonergan and that sort of thing. You know. That's the area of research and interest.
Okay. Why did you first come to St. Mary's?
The summer of 1950, believe it or not.
Okay, what was the school like when you first came?
We were still up on Windsor Street, where the present... St. Vincent Guest House is now, but we were in this very small little building, and the total college population was 188 students. I've taught a single class at the university of 210 students, larger than the entire college population was when I first came, so you can see the growth. The place has gone through. Now, there was also the high school attached because in those days they looked on, the institution as a 7 or 8 year course. So if you came from grade 11, then you did the 4 years high school and 3 years university, I guess. So that it was considered more as a unit. It was only later that the high school, when we closed it up, we concentrated then on the college and university section. I was the ogre, one of the chief ogres that canceled the high school because we needed the space. We had to get more room, and they were using up valuable classroom space in the main administration building, which was all we had. So. Something had to be done about it, so very regretfully we closed the high school, which was an excellent school, but the other schools in the city, or some especially St. Pat's, complained because we were creaming off all the top students. The high school, they all wanted to come to St. Mary's High School, and that didn't help us with some of the other schools. Mm-hmm. So that we closed that in 1963, I think it was. But it was limited to 100 students, you know, over the 3 years of the high school that we had here. But we were able to get the better students from from St. Pat's and some of the other schools as a result.
Mm-hmm. So when did the campus move?
The campus moved to the new Gorsebrook campus in 1951, the fall of 51. You had to walk over boardwalks and wade through mud and so on. The place was far from finished, but yet they moved down. People had no idea what it was like then. The wooden scaffolding was still around. Well, the front of the building was finished, but the sides and the rest were just concrete. No stone, no brick. And that took years for that to get finished. They just had run out of money. In fact, the whole operation nearly came to a halt altogether because of the money that was being spent, and the diocese was going into debt as a result. But the board of board of governors, because we didn't have a board of governors, and then we had the Senate. What was called the Senate later was changed to become the Board of Governors. In those days, the Senate in some institutions was equivalent to the Board of Governors. So, and this is confusing in documents because people read about the Senate said this or did this and think of it in terms of the present Senate, which is an academic body and controls the academic side of the institution. But the Senate then was equivalent roughly to the Board of Governors, though it didn't have, more than deliberative or consultative power. It wasn't a governing body in the strict sense of the word. It was advisory to the president, put it that way. Mm-hmm. So the administrative structure has changed considerably.
So at that time, was the administration entirely Jesuit?
Yes, the administration was entirely Jesuit, yeah. Mm-hmm. We had a president who was also rector, President Rector, who was rector of the Jesuit community, and president of the university. So that, and that the Jesuits came in 1940 only. So we took over administration of the university in 1940 from the Christian Brothers, who had operated the place since, 1913 or 14. We administered the place and then went through the move and so on from the Windsor Street place down here to the student campus. The rest, I suppose, is history. It mushroomed over the years.
Yeah. What were the academic programs like in those early years?
Academic programs were much more structured, perhaps, is the word I'm looking for. That is, there were far fewer electives. In the Bachelor of Arts program, for example, you had to do a philosophy each year and a theology each year and English each year and so on. The entrance requirements, I think, were far stricter then, because to get into the St. Mary's, a student had to have, English, history, mathematics, a science, a foreign language, and so on as entrance requirements. So that made it tougher, I think, than what they have today, where they'll accept things like social sciences and all the other recognized subjects in a high school curriculum, which we didn't recognize. So that the brand of student that we got in was generally well-equipped for college work, especially for arts. And if they're going into science, then they had to have even other requirements regarding the science program and courses that they've done, and the mathematics. But that's been one of the, failures too hard a word, but at least of the weakening of the high school programs, I think, is how they have know, slowly whittled away things like mathematics, natural science, and foreign language requirements and to get into the college. And Latin, I know, was something that we expected students to have had if they're going into art. So it's quite a change.
So how did the academic programs change over the years that you were there? How many years were you there?
How many years? I mean, how many to get a degree, or?
How many years were you at St. Mary's yourself?
Well, I started in 1950. I was away the next year for studies in the States, and then I came back, and I've been there ever since. Except, well, all retired, but have a somewhat of an affiliation with the university as a, I suppose, a member of the Convocation Committee and in Marshall of Convocation, but I haven't taught since 1982.
So how did you notice changes in academic programs from 1950 to 1982? What changes did you see?
Well, I think the most noticeable change, perhaps, is in the requirements in the degree program. As I mentioned, you had to do in English, you had to do a philosophy, you had to do a theology in the first years. That requirement was later dropped, but there were very little room for electives in the program. There were, you know, sort of set program in arts and commerce and science. You had to do these prescribed courses, and later, of course, they, because of pressure from departments and the rest, they began to make room for more electives in the program. But initially, you had those prescribed courses, as I say, like English, philosophy, mathematics, and so on. And you might have, in your junior year, say, room for two or three electives, and or you carried an extra course to take another elective. Some people were able to, if their average was good enough or high enough, we'd let them take six courses. And,
So what type of extracurricular activities went on in campus in those early years?
There were all sorts of extracurricular activities. I don't suppose any more than what we know going on now, but you had your resident society, I think it was, and then there was the Christian Life Movement, it's called today, the Sodality, which was a religious organization of students, and the COTC, the Officers Training Corps, was still in operation then, and you had students who would, be in the Naval Training Program or Army Training Program and so on. But that phased out after the war, when the government stopped funding cadets and officers' training programs and so on. But that filled a good part of student life at one time. And then there were the athletics, the drama, which I got involved in very early on. And, I suppose apart from the ordinary academic life and then the games, the athletic side of it, and these other societies, that was about it.
Okay. Let's talk about the period around the end of the 1960s when women were first admitted to the institution. What type of effect did that have?
Well, it met with mixed reactions. When I was in administration, I had taken steps to try to turn us towards the co-education, largely because there were girls that wanted to take particular courses that they could get only at the university and couldn't get at the Mount and so forth. And the Jesuits had tried to get together with the Mount. We made overtures to the Mount in an effort to get them to join us and come in with us. In fact, sisters were offered a part of the campus or a building, in an effort to attract them and have them put up their new building on our campus there, and then it would have been a cooperative effort between the Mount and St. Mary's. And if that had happened, there's no telling, we'd probably be twice the size today. But the Mount would have none of it, in a sense. No, the Mount was strictly for the education of women, and they weren't interested in joining forces with the boys' college. And I remember dear Sister Frances of Assisi, God bless her soul, some of the correspondence should have been written on asbestos paper. It was, but nothing ever came of it again, because they just weren't interested in a coeducational effort. Well, I could see that coeducation was inevitable or going to come, and certainly for St. Mary's if we were going to grow. So a student came one day, a girl, said that she wanted to do courses, so I found out what she wanted to do, made sure she couldn't get them anywhere else, and took her in as a full-time student. And then Eileen O'Leary, first that was Jocelyn Grassby, who graduated very well and then ended up in the East somewhere. She was that's beside the point, but slowly, having squeezed in one or two girls like that, I got jumped on by the Archbishop, jumped on by the President, just about everybody else, for sneaking these female types into the place. But eventually, in 69, was it, then the place became officially coeducational, because we couldn't get them out to move, and trying to remain solely a boys' college was impossible, or at least, well, not impossible, but was certainly hindering growth. We were always coeducational in the evening division. The evening division was started by Pat Malone, who was the Dean of Studies, or Academic Vice President, we would call it today. And he started the courses in the evening division, and by accident, I happened to be the first teacher to teach, because the first course offered was introductory philosophy, which was my area. So 1952 in the fall, I taught the first evening course, but it was to a mixed group, largely teachers and military personnel, people like that. And the evening division, of course, has gone on and continued and done a great service, I think, to the teachers, for the teachers at Halifax, enabling them to get degrees and so on. But back to the coeducation thing, once that was cleared, then the place started to grow and slowly until now. I'm not sure what the proportion is, but I think there are probably as many women as, if not more, than there are male students in the place. I don't know what the breakdown is today, but I think there'd be, certainly it's 50%, if not more. I'd have to look at the statistics. Elizabeth Chard would probably know if they still keep such things. Yeah. Well, maybe turbulent history is too strong a word, but it was never, just a smooth progression, because we had to fight those who opposed coeducation, many of them the students themselves. The attitudes in those days were so different from what they are now. The boys didn't want girls around the campus and messing around and spoiling their fun or whatever, but you'd think that the boys would be all in favor of having the girls, but there was a lot of opposition there and in other quarters. Of course, once they got the girls in, then they just again moved from that and then on. But that's not all that long ago when you think of 69, 70, when the place became fully coeducational. That's only a history of 20-some years, isn't it? Mm-hmm.
So besides being a philosophy faculty member, what other roles did you have at the university over the years?
What other roles did I play in the university? Well, when I came to Halifax, I was resolved not to have anything to do with theater because I knew from my experience in Montreal how time-consuming it could do. And the first 4 years I never went near the Dramatic Society or anything until finally one day the moderator of the society said, "You know something about theater, I just need advice." So I went down to the stage and up as if. First thing I knew I had my coat off. So that was one aspect of my work, which was not academic. It was just helping, especially with the technical side of the dramatic production. Academically, in 59, was it 59? Yes, I became Dean of Studies, was the title used then, with the present title being Academic Vice President. And I held that office for until, say, in 63 I went out of office. But, it was a good period in the sense because the place was developing. We didn't have any departments, so I made guidelines and set up a number of departments. You had to have at least 3 faculty in the subject field to become a department, etc., etc. And then I worked very hard to get the Senate established and to write terms of reference for the Senate. And that, I presided over the first meeting of the University Senate in the spring of 63. And the rest, again, is history, I suppose. And slowly, departments got built up and faculties developed with your normal university growth. And then once I got out of office in 63, I went back to teaching full-time, along with other activities and so forth. I was one of the founding fathers of APICS, the Atlantic Provinces Inter-University Committee on the Sciences. And when did we found that? 62 or 63, my secretary of that organization, and it's still going apparently and flourishing. So that was one development that we had. It was an adjunct to the university, though not part of it. And I was taught, and then finally, 76 was it? 75, 76, I got a sabbatical year at last. I was ready for that, and I went to Toronto to work on Lonergan and subject, and was developing a new course in Lonergan. And Christmas time, or halfway through the year, I got this call: "We need you home. The Dean of Arts has had a heart attack. Come back and take over as dean again." So, first thing I knew, I found myself back replacing Dr. Owen as Dean of Arts and Science. It was a combined office then. We didn't have a separate Dean of Science. So, I think I was Dean of Arts and Science initially. And then from being Dean of Arts, and the next year I became Assistant Academic Vice President, and then after that, Academic Vice President, or Acting Academic Vice President, I suppose, more accurately. And I held that office and a couple of years until, who was it that took over? Jabra? Dr. Jabra, I think, in political, who was in the political science department. And he's now Academic Vice President in California. So that's about a brief history as far as the academic side is concerned. But it was enough to keep me busy. So I enjoyed administration. I suppose I have been in administration more in a sense, longer. Well, 16 of my years I was in some administrative post out of the 31 or 2 that I was active at the university. So I think that would, though I tried to keep one course going just to keep my hand in, I felt closer to the faculty when I was teaching and could relate more to their problems if I myself was teaching a course in the classroom, which I did. One small advanced course, which wasn't a great load as far as correcting. Different from teaching 210 students when you had to burn the midnight oil with essays and exams, and that was brutal to go through that. And then, oh, I forgot that when I first came, I was also made university librarian because I had librarian experience when I was in Guelph, Toronto, was it, and worked under a librarian there. So we got a gift to start the E.H. Horn Memorial Library, which occupied the space now that the engineering faculty has, that big room there. We got a gift of $20,000 to set it up, so I got that going and developed and so on. So I was in administration as the university's librarian, as well as being involved in the teaching side of it too.
So the size of the university increased a lot during the years that you were there.
Oh, yes, it grew tremendously. I say, arriving to find 188 college students, and the first thing I knew, it was in the hundreds. It was still small as an institution goes. I forget them. Well, I'd have to look back to remember how many hundred students we actually had, but we just had the one main building in the administration building there, so that you met the students in the corridors everywhere. You got to know everybody by first name, and if I met a student didn't know, I might ask him, "Who are you? Where are you from? What's your name?" So that you got to know the people. And there were only, when there were 600 students, it's not a far cry from 6,000 or 5,000. So that, then the Burke Education Center, we built that in 65. We worked very hard on those plans. Every light switch, we had to decide which side of the door it was going on. You know, that kind of thing when you're looking over building plans. My great regret was that we didn't have the money to build it as we had planned it, because our budget was severely limited. We were told by the board $600,000 is all you can spend, and the quotations came in the lowest at $800,000. So get out the carving knife and cut off about a third of your building. But that Burke Education Center, the end of it towards the science building was a, what do they call that type of wall? It's not a false wall, but a wall that wasn't permanently solid, so that if the other section of the building was ever built, it could be added on to the Burke building. It's too bad that we didn't have the money for it at the time, but however, we needed it because it wasn't too many years before the Burke building became hopelessly too small for the library. So before the building was ever finished, even as a library, we had to make plans to build a new library, which was, 72, I think? See, the Burke opened in 65, and in 72 we were starting work on the new university library, and I think it opened then. Memory, I tell you, I remember attending the opening, but and that building was never fully finished in the sense it couldn't go up, I think, two more floors, saying that the science building is capable of expansion. Well, it initially was 3 floors, and I think we got it up to 5. And something like the student center, which was, I think, capable of 8 stories, and has only gone to 5, is it? Yeah. So these buildings were planned with the possibility of future development. But they did add to the science building. But, it's awfully messy at times. Going along with building construction and so on while you're still having plans. And I remember when we originally moved down to St. Mary's, one of the carpenters came, said he should get a degree because he'd been in so many classes while he was working on the building. You know, there'd be a knock on the door and then would come a carpenter to fix a window. You're in that type of situation. Well, there have been many, many changes and developments since.
Let's talk about when the administration in the 70s passed from the Jesuits and it became a secular institution.
Yes. Well, it all began because we could see the handwriting on the wall as far as our administration was concerned. And I didn't feel it was fair for the handful of Jesuits that we were becoming to control all the administrative positions. There were lots of good faculty people and others who could take over the jobs like deans and things like that. I was much more anxious to see the Jesuits in teaching positions than in administrative positions. And I wrote the provincial about getting substitutes. If we were going to continue an administration, then we had to have a president and so on. And he wrote back, I can't guarantee that I can give you a man who has the qualifications and abilities to be a president. So when you see things like that going on, you say we've got to involve the laity in these administrative jobs, which we did, and I was on the charter committee for the new charter of the university, and we worked on that for a year, I guess, or more, and then we got the new charter, and the place effectively was turned over to the University Board of Governors, which now controls the institution, and well, I guess that's about it. The Board of Governors, they say, prior to that time, the Board of Governors, which, as I mentioned, was also initially the Senate. The Senate was more a consultative and advisory group than a legislative body. It didn't have effective power. The president and of course, the archbishop, too, because we were really, had to work along with the diocese that owned the place, and the archdiocese had the financial ownership of the institution. We just had the administration, but we had to work together on any developments like that. In fact, I think the archdiocese still owns a good part of the university land. They've been buying it back, but when the new library was being built, one of the problems was to find a piece of land that the university owned on which the library could be put without having to buy it back from the archdiocese. Because the university was in, owed the archdiocese $250,000 or something more dollars. And, so they were hardly in a position to buy more land. But I don't know today how much the university has bought back of all that land and how much the diocese still owns, if any. But that was part of the deal, that we would hand over the buildings and the administration and everything to the Board of Governors while the diocese kept the land, or a good part of the land, because it needed it. for its equity and because of the debt and so forth that was on the Archdiocese for the university.
So did the nature of the institution change after the transition?
The nature of the institution, well, its direction in many ways, yes. When you go from direction of a religious order to lay president and lay board of governors and so on, things are bound to change. The course requirements and so forth, these would, well, they became much more along the lines of the ordinary public institution or university. Of course, requirements and the departments had to be tailored to fit what courses were needed for a particular degree. So you were doing political science, history, so on, to try to get enough courses into the program to make sure that the student had the proper undergraduate preparation, especially in view of graduate school, because we were always very conscious not just of the bachelor's degree, but of students moving on to do graduate work, and we had to prepare them adequately for graduate work. We never had any great problem getting our students into graduate school, though, that I can remember. The development, I'm trying to say, I suppose it was gradual, but the emphasis does shift a bit when you get out from a Jesuit or religious order administration into a lay board, and the Senate the same way. It took over completely the academic side of the institution, and the lay board took over the financial and side. Although it has supreme power, it can overrule the Senate if it ever wants to. Fortunately, wise enough not to interfere in the academic side. Though they've had some battles over some of the course offerings or things that the Senate was doing that have come before the board, but that didn't happen too often. Well, I think it was a good division. Took a lot of work, that charter committee, and the charter, I felt, was too weak. I say that even though I was a member of the charter committee, but we had this advisor from Ottawa who came down, and I felt that our clauses in the charter weren't much more than motherhood clauses, which what they amount to, you know, the university faithful to the Christian tradition, that's about what it said, which could mean just about everything. I wanted a stronger position, policy statement regarding the tradition of the university and its background and its commitment to Christian education and so forth, but that's all gone in effect today, you know. This Christian principles or whatever it is a very, as I say, like a motherhood sort of clause, and I felt that we should have, without being denominational, but because we accepted it, even way back right from the time I came to St. Mary's, there were non-Catholics, students, Jewish students, and so on in the courses. I taught them myself, and there were many of them are very good students. But we never required, in fact, the original St. Mary's Charter stated that way back in 1841, was it, that no student or professor or anybody can be required to, take or adhere to any particular religious faith and so on. It was, the university was open to all. But because of the Christian tradition and its founding fathers, you might say, or people in the archdiocese. There was naturally a strong Christian tradition in the place.
So do you feel there's any of that left?
There are some professors who are, for the older ones, that still seem conscious of this, but it's more a talk than anything else. Right now, as far as I can see, the university is just another public institution, and it would be entirely up to an individual professor to, you know, in his attitudes and so on. You can't proselytize in the classroom. I would be dead against that. The classroom is for information and teaching, not for converting people or trying to proselytize. It's just in the general atmosphere and the way things are run that makes a difference in the place, and the attitudes of people. If the professors themselves have a Christian attitude towards people, you know, in their understanding of, say, especially of the underprivileged, and well, we've always been committed to the disabled and less fortunate people. That was, St. Mary's has always had that in its as a policy, and right from, I suppose, as long as I can remember. And I've taught blind students in class and that sort of thing. But we've never had a policy that says, you know, to come to St. Mary's, you've got to be a Catholic or you've got to be even a Christian. We have Jews, as I say, in class, and other students. So we never had any religious test, in other words, right from the start. And I've never tried to put it in, relying mostly, as I say, on the whole notion of the place as a Christian institution, that the professors themselves would lead more by example, if you want to call it that, and their attitudes, than by any sort of direct proselytizing, anything like that. We wouldn't want that to happen. But, yeah, go ahead, no.
You're the one you
want to
hear.
Well, no, I'm just saying, I know there are people that sometimes have crossed the bound one way or another. There are problems arising at times, as I know, in the faculty, that there was one faculty member I can recall. He was only at the university for 3 years, I think, but he was saying all sorts of things in class about the Jesuits were all homosexuals, and we were, you know, saying things like that, and the things he was telling the students, even the students themselves were objecting, and there's no room for that sort of thing in the classroom. And fortunately, the man left, and the department wanted to get rid of him, and it's not always easy to do. Because when the man is on a, if he's on a tenure stream, it's very difficult to bounce him unless you've got just cause. But this man was a nut, I'm convinced. He was a, well, we had one man, I remember, Silverstein. Yeah. Very fine person to talk to at the start. And then we discovered that his papers that he had, papers of Oxford University, graduate and master's and something, were all forged, all forged. So we had to get rid of him. He was a strange bird. But this other fellow was, he left and just wasn't a good teacher to begin with. And, very difficult when you're in administration and you have a poor teacher to get rid of them. Because the other faculty members gang up on them. And, I know when I've had to fire faculty, I remember one man breaking down and weeping in my shoulder or in my office when I fired him. And that's hard to take. I had warned them and given them a year to improve, and at the end of the year I said, the student complaints are the same and as strong as ever, and I warned you, goodbye. So you learn to take this sort of thing, and and the odd part of it was, he went down to the States, this man, and kept writing me letters, asking for letters of recommendation for his applications. You think, having been fired by me, that he'd be the last person he'd want to approach for an academic reference. But I can't even think of the man's name now. Again, a nice chap and a highly cultured person, but he couldn't speak English, and you can't have a man who doesn't speak English teaching a student. And the students complained that they couldn't understand him, and I said, learn English or else. And he didn't, so he went. An Italian professor with all sorts of European degrees, and as I say, a highly cultured man, but can't put a man like that in the classroom because you owe it to the students to give them somebody they can understand. Helps.
Okay, the faculty union came in about shortly after.
72, I think, the faculty union. I was a charter member of the faculty union, as a matter of fact, but and the union. Many people regret the advent of the union, but again, I think it was inevitable. We were the one of three universities, I think, at the time in the country to become unionized, a faculty union. But because of administrative problems and so on at the time, the faculty felt their only protection was to form a union, and they did. And subsequently, of course, other universities, their faculties became unionized across, I guess, across Canada now. The vast majority of faculties and universities are unionized. But it was very unusual in those days, and people had said, oh, you'll have all sorts of headaches if you get the faculty unionized. Well, they did, and we had all sorts of headaches as a result. But I think, in fairness to the faculty, and at that time I was a faculty member and I joined the union, to get the faculty points across and to redress grievances and so on and so forth. But it took a long time to form a proper faculty manual. Part of the problem was that the original faculty manual, which was much smaller, which I had written back in 1960-61, whenever governing appointments, promotions, tenure, that was left. It was never revised. Senate made all sorts of changes and things like that, but instead of updating the manual, people would look at the manual and then, of course, forget about a Senate resolution. So it was unfortunate that we needed, what should I say, an updater or some way of bringing the manual year by year up to date with decisions of the board or Senate that affected faculty.